talk a lot about power spectrum today and how we got to lambda CDM and how that did and did not depend on the power spectrum, but does now. Last time had introduced the galaxy pair of power spectrum. So this is a depiction from 2001. This is actually late in this game. It was in the early 90s that people were doing that, that this really started to push us away from then standard CDM, which had a mega matter equals one, and had the Hubble constant around 50. And that was the hang up then, that it had to be omega matter equals one. Just as the hang up today is that the dark matter has to be some non-baryonic coulter. This is a little glimpse. So when you look at the galaxy power spectrum, this is a Fourier transform of the correlation function, which remember just measures how likely you are to find one galaxy close to another. So it's a statistical description of the distribution of galaxies on the sky. And being a Fourier transform, it's of a spatial thing. The inverse is a wave number. So small wave numbers are large scales. Large wave numbers are small scales. So individual galaxies are down here, and then the separation between them are up here. And there's a lot of correlation there. And much was made all through the 90s of the fact that this power spectrum is basically a measure of the RMS, and I'll come back to how you understand that, but it's the variance of structure within these different scales. That depended on basically what's called the shape parameter, the product of omega matter times the Hubble constant, and we saw this diagram before, different combinations of omega matter and the Hubble constant give you different shapes in this diagram. So to first order, it's just that product, omega mh. In detail, it has this more complicated formula. This whole piece here is close to 1. Close to 1, and so to first order is just that leading term. Right? In detail, it does depend on the baryon density, so there's an exponential, omega baryon appears there, omega baryon over omega m there, so it depends on the baryon fraction. And this whole term for modern values is not 1, but about 0.8, so that brings the shape parameter down somewhat. Similarly, n is the tilt of the power spectrum, and it is close to 1, but not exactly 1. If it's exactly 1, this whole term is 0. And since this is close to 1, this is a small correction. So again, basically, omega mh is the leading term and what we care about. But there is, in detail, this dependence on the baryon density and the baryon fraction. And that's why the dashed lines differ from the solid lines. The dashed lines are just omega mh with a baryon fraction of 0. So that this term is exactly unity. But when you allow for baryons, then that term drags you down. So you can see that the solid line is lower than the dashed line. That's the first effect of that baryonic damping, is to drag down the power. It does so more on small scales than on large, so everything looks the same on large scales, which is why cosmologists love large scales. They don't have to worry about these unpleasant details. And then that effect gets stronger as you go to larger baryon fractions, so basically lower omega matter for the same baryon. So this here is a bigger change than that to there. The other thing you notice are these wiggles. So the baryonic acoustic oscillations that are frozen in the plasma at the time of the CMB get erased by the growth of large-scale structure, which is mostly happening in the dark matter. But if the dark matter fraction is modest, then some of that is preserved in those gains. So that's basically that term, which imprints the scale dependence,
as well as dragging the whole thing down.
So this is one of the important things that in the early 90s drove us away from standard CDM. And I bother to tell you this story because I cannot impress on you enough the degree to which people at the time were absolutely convinced that standard CDM was correct. Just as much as they are convinced now that lambda CDM is correct. It was very hard to switch from one to the other. And there's no reason to think we cannot be just as wrong again. But the reason we really, really believed omega matter had to be one coming out of the 80s was because of inflationary theory, which hopefully we'll get to, but basically that drives, what was predicted to drive, the mass density to exactly one. And for the age problem, which you saw in your homework, to work out, then you needed a low value of the Hubble constant. Measurement provided by Sandage and collaborators was right around 50. So the product of omega m times h was expected to be a half. Now nobody believed that it was exactly 50 at the time, just very close to that. So it could have been a little more or less than a half. But a half doesn't even make it onto this plot. Right? It's nowhere in the range that the data are. And the data are around 0.2. 0.3 up here, 0.1 out there, it's somewhere in between. And so through much tribulation, we wound up with a shape parameter that's consistent with what we now call vanilla lambda CDM, make a matter of 0.3 and 0.7, right? That product is 0.21, which is consistent with the 0.2 there, modulo the effective variance. So that was one of the many things that drove us away towards standard CDM and towards lambda CDM. But notice this has nothing to do with lambda. Just omega matter and h and a little term for baryons. There's no lambda in this particular thing. So that did not require us to get lambda yet. Okay. So there was a steady drip, 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 drip of results all through the 90s, starting with the Saviu 1990, pointed that out. And by 1995, I would, to be specific, assign it to this paper, this is where lambda CDM became standard. Now, there is no one time when lambda CDM became standard. It almost never happens that you have one result that tips the scales. There has to be a whole steady range of things, and there had been. But what Ostreicher and Steinhardt did in this little Nature letter in 95 was put together a whole bunch of the constraints and plot up this omega matter H diagram, which is why I asked you to do the same thing. That's how we got to lambda CDM. And these are the constraints they considered at the time, one of which is that shape parameter. This is the range that was allowed at the time for that product of omega matter times h. So that sweeps out this band. The baryon fraction of clusters sweeps out this band. Basically, you could measure the dynamical masses of clusters, and you knew what the omega baryon was from BBN. So if you assumed that clusters were representative of the baryon fraction of the whole, you could use the baryon fraction of clusters and BBN to get back to omega matter, and that gives you this band here. So that kind of excludes very low Hubble constants. Those were never plausible, but this and this don't overlap, right? So you want to find a place where all the constraints overlap. There was a generous range of Hubble constants allowed at the time, less than 60, more than 80, somewhere in there. And they also said that very low omega matter was excluded by various dynamical observations. And so basically, where all these things overlap is this darker gray area. And that's what they called the concordance cosmology. Now, at the time, oh, and then there's the age constraint here. And they just had a very weak constraint on the age that it was more than an 11 and a half gigawatt years. But there's a different line for an open universe without a cosmological constant and a flat one with omega matter plus omega lambda equals 1. And at the time, there wasn't much to choose between these, but they advocated for omega lambda. And I think this was coupled to their confirmation bias. Steinhardt was one of the early advocates of inflation and inventors of that. And they were desperately trying to save inflation. I told you a few minutes ago that inflation predicted that omega matter was 1, which is what it predicted. But you could save the theory, because if you thought about it, really all that inflation required was that the geometry was written to 1, so omega curvature was 0. If we accept, finally, because the data almost always said this, that omega matter was lowish, not 1, then to have a flat geometry, you had to have a cosmological constant. Up until that point, that was verboten. That was Einstein's greatest blunder. It was a stupid idea. It never should have been there, so we will not talk about it. So that was one of the sort of social attitudes that we had to get over in doing this, and they went a long way to doing that, even though, like I say, there wasn't really much to choose here between an open universe without a cosmological constant, but with curvature, and one without. Now, of course, we continue to work on these things so you can tighten up the constraints. And this is what I had you do. It's the same plot that's in the solutions you see. So here's just the Hubble constant constraint, if you believe, whichever measure you want. This I've taken from Tully, I think. But, you know, if you choose 67, it's down here, right? And those are significantly different. But the point is that the age of the universe depends on its expansion history, which depends on omega lambda, as well as omega matter. So where the shape parameter did not require lambda, this does. And you can only get an age of the universe that's consistent with everything else for that flat geometry. Wasn't true back then, but it is true now, that there is no overlap with the open case for any viable value of the Hubble constant and omega matter. So this at the time was a really important driver, along with all these other things, of accepting a cosmological constant. Again, we really needed this extra time that the cosmological constant bought us. And remember, the reason for that is the detailed shape of the expansion history. There's coasting limit, right? Omega matter is 0. There's a flat omega matter equals 1 universe. So an open universe would have been somewhere in between here. Lambda CDM first decelerates and then accelerates. So they're headed towards the de Sitter limit, but we're not there yet. And early on, remember, everything is in the matter-dominated limit immediately after the radiation-dominated limit. So you start out decelerating. But then you have an inflection point where you turn around to acceleration. And the whole point here was to buy you a couple of extra billion years. Right, so we live somewhere now, and an open universe only gets you back to, you know, 12 billion years ago. Lambda CDM gets you back to 14 billion years ago, or something like that. It also buys you more time to form structure in the early universe. So already in the 90s, we were seeing things like quasars at redshift 4 that were uncomfortably early. It's great
review paper I found by David Tram in, I think, 92, who was just saying, look, there are quasars at redshift 3, almost 4. How can this be?
Because he had omega matter equals 1 firmly in mind, and there just wasn't enough time to make those things.
I would love for him to be around so I could see what he thought of things at Z of 10.
But anyway, we didn't have Z of 10 things yet, but we did have things at high enough redshift that we wanted to buy that extra time to have time to form them, and that problem has gotten worse. So we're in this weird situation where lambda CDM is a really great fit to the power spectrum. There's the CMB power spectrum. But it has been surprised by it over and over again, that there has always been structure in place on larger scales and at earlier times than was expected by the theory as it existed at that time. Okay, so Ostreicher and Steinhardt were also the first that I'm aware of. Well, I'm sure it wasn't the first, but they were the first to publish the acoustic power spectrum as a serious cosmological test. I'm sure they weren't the first, because lots and lots of people were working towards this goal, and so there were already data here. This is mid-90s, remember. COBE was relatively new. That was 92. Okay, so we had only just detected fluctuations on the largest scales. We knew that they had to be there, or at least we were convinced that was the case, and it proved to be correct about that. But the amplitude and distribution were unknowns. So we sort of had measured this relatively well. That was actually surprisingly high compared to standard CDM. You can't tell it here. So let's look at the models. These are three models they tried, and obviously there's not much constraining power in the data that were available at the time. So they just said, let's try some obvious possibilities. So an open cold dark matter universe that's got curvature but no lambda, so you need a lowish H-naught. You could have gone lower on that, but that's what they chose to illustrate. And that's this really high line. So there's a competition between the baryons and the dark matter. The baryons want to make the fluctuations high. Would be only one part in 1,000 if it were just baryons, right? And the dark matter, which suppresses that, pushes it down. So standard CDM, which was still what a lot of people wanted to believe at the time, the omega matter equals 1, H of 50, that's that dashed line. And you can see it's much lower in overall amplitude because the dark matter density is higher. They kept the baryon density the same throughout these things, because we knew that from BBN, even though that's not the same number that we know now. They used Craig Coby's 0.015 rather than the modern 0.024, whatever. So you can see that overall amplitude shifts, but the important thing for the geometry is the location of the peak. That peak is at much finer angular scales than a flat geometry. And another way to make the flat geometry is what we now call lambda CDM. And these are the numbers they used, omega matter 0.35, Hubble constant 65, lambda 0.65. That's really close to Planck values now. A very, very good guess. Planck would be 0.33, 0.72. Whatever the difference is there, now 0.67. And 67, right? So that's really close, except for the baryon density. So when we look at this in detail, we'll see that this peak is much smaller now because of the higher baryon density. Which they didn't even worry about at the time, because we knew that from Big Bang nuclear synthesis. And you can see there was a smattering of data there that basically said, yeah, maybe there's power here. You look at the size of the error bars, and it's a 2 sigma detection. So these are in the right ballpark, but they really didn't tell us anything. And much of this constrained power comes from this upper limit, which does prove to have been correct. It was lower than that. But anyway, this was one of their arguments for Lyman's EDM, and a real prediction, right? So that's good. You should always make predictions. There's a lot more that goes on, so if you're actually curious about this, I wrote a whole post about the history of how we, coming out of the 80s, believed absolutely in standard CDM, and by the end of the 90s, absolutely believed in lambda CDM, which is where we still are today. Okay. So now there is a connection between this acoustic power spectrum, which is a snapshot of the distribution of temperature fluctuations at the redshift of recombination, which is just over a redshift of 1,000, 1090, and the distribution of galaxies today. The conceit, the assumption, is that these little bitty fluctuations in temperature correspond to density fluctuations that over time grow and become the distribution of galaxies that we see, just through gravity. That gravitational growth is that the perturbation amplitude grows as at the same rate as the scale size. And so you can extrapolate this linearly, at least on the largest scales. And so these green points up here are the CME points from down here, extrapolated up by that linear growth factor of 1,090. And that maps smoothly onto the galaxy data. Modulo some assumption about the bias factor, but that's a small number compared to this many orders of magnitude. But this works only for lambda CDM because of the shape parameter we're talking about. Standard CDM predicted something way down here. So one of the many reasons we have to invoke lambda, though it doesn't play a role in the shape parameter, but we did have to accept the matter density was lower, and that skews the power to larger scales. Okay. And remember, this galaxy power spectrum measured at redshift 0 is measured through the correlation function, which is this excess probability of finding one galaxy near to another compared to a random distribution. And that's related to the power spectrum by a Fourier transform. That's the top plot. The bottom plot is a Fourier transformation of temperature fluctuations on the sky, which correspond to density fluctuations. And on this larger scale, right, before this turnover, then the power spectrum there has a nearly linear shape as just the wave number to the end. And that N is that index that I've mentioned that's very close to 1. Right? So it's initially scale-free with N very close to 1. We think the best fit measured. The best fit now is about 0.96. But scale-free is inherent in the nature of cold dark matter. Cold dark matter particles are slow-moving. So they do not care if you are a dwarf galaxy or a big galaxy or a cluster of galaxies or the whole universe, it's slow-moving particles. And so there's no scale that gets imprinted on this because of the nature of dark matter. That is, it's scale-free in this one, in this terminology. There is a scale that's imprinted by the horizon, right, in the structure form. So there is a whole mathematics of the transfer function that it, what happens is perturbations go from being super horizon, the horizon grows and catches up to them, so it's said that they enter the horizon and they can interact with things that they're certainly in causal contact with. And that basically results in this turnover. And in the very highly nonlinear regime down here is where galaxies form and live and lots of interesting things happen. So cosmologists prefer to live in this linear regime. Remember, 8 megaparsecs is the scale of where delta is 1. So you want to live in the limit of perturbation theory, well, delta is much smaller than 1, so that's on much larger scales than megaparsecs. On smaller scales, like a galaxy, are already nonlinear, and that means there's evolution that cannot be treated by perturbation theory. You can actually form real objects like galaxies, not just some distribution of the spider web that we see as the cosmic web. Okay, so these things are tied by this linear growth, and it's just assumed that that's what's going on in order to put the CMB data from redshift of 1,000 on the galaxy data redshift 0. Okay, so we'll talk a little more about the power spectrum because it is confusing as all get out. You know, I can say that's a Fourier transform, and you can look up mathematically what a Fourier transform is, and you can probably find some Python tool that will do it for you, but it doesn't give you much physical intuition. Just saying. And that's important. The whole point of science is to understand what is going on and to develop an intuition for how things work physically. So while this is a really convenient statistical description, it takes a while to wrap your head around what it means physically. So some definitions to remember: this overdensity is defined as the actual density in any sphere, and we're going to consider spheres of all sizes. So it's the density divided by the average density. So are you a little more dense or a little less dense than average? And in the early universe, everything is close to average, but you have these small perturbations of order 1 part in 100,000 to start with at redshift 1,000. And then you want to know about that at all scales. So here's the wave number. It's related to the wavelength lambda, which is an actual physical scale, be it 8 megaparsecs, where delta is about 1 or larger or smaller. And you get this inverse relation whenever you do a Fourier transform. So at its heart, cold dark matter gives you this scale-free power law spectrum that on the largest scales where you're in the linear regime, it's just k to the n. So it goes as wave number to n, and n is very close to 1, which is scale-free. Inflation, one of the neat things that inflation does for us and why we still cling to it, is that it gives a natural explanation for why that is so. Basically, one imagines that in the early universe there are just quantum fluctuations, which by construction are random. And then you have this period of inflation that takes those teeny things and blows them up to the size of the universe. So the random field, scale-free, of just quantum fluctuations get blown up to the cosmic scale and give you this primordial power spectrum. So inflation gives a really compelling reason why we have a scale. Okay. On the other hand, we shouldn't cling to that too hard because it's a Gaussian random field. What the heck else would it be? So inflation gives us a good reason for it to be that, but any random thing might do that. Okay, but that's the starting point, is just that linear power spectrum, the number of fluctuations, the amplitude of fluctuations correlate to their scale, and there are more on smaller scales, right, larger wave numbers, just because they're smaller, so there are more of them. You can also think of this in terms of a mass, so if you go back in the literature, you'll sometimes see it written this way. And of course, the mass in any of these volumes, and the power of using this Fourier mechanics in the power spectrum is that it lets you deal statistically with all scales simultaneously, because there are fluctuations on all scales all the time. And the mass, of course, just scales as the volume, because the density is very much the same. So you can think about the mass that corresponds to a wave number or a wavelength. Question is, if you want to make a galaxy like the Milky Way, how big a co-moving wavelength do you need to encompass that much mass? Right? You know what the average density of the universe is, you know what the critical density is, You can ask yourself how much of the early universe you have to scoop up to make a galaxy mass object. And then the RMS variation in that, you can basically translate, that's the RMS squared, right? It's the variation squared. The variations average out if you just take the linear average, but the RMS doesn't because of the square. And so that RMS scales as mass, n is close to 1, so this is the minus 2/3. Again, there are lots of small things, not many big things. And this is the origin of the predicted power spectrum of dark matter halos. You know what the number density is as a function of mass. It basically goes back to this. How many little things are there? How many big things are there? And there should be lots of little things for every big things, which is why we have problems with the flat-ish luminosity function. We really expected there should be a lot of dwarf galaxies for every giant galaxy, but we observe more, but only a few more. But anyway, this is mathematically, you got to have a lot more dark matter halos, if not actual galaxies. And remember, this is all normalized to the scale of 8 megaparsecs, which is historically chosen just because that's the scale on which the numbers of galaxies, the RMS, was 1. So you put down a sphere of 8 megaparsecs, and you see a galaxy, and the next sphere you don't, and that RMS is 1 on that scale. So that's the dividing line between linearity and nonlinearity. Strictly speaking, you want to be much less than 1 to be in the cleanly linear regime, so on scales much larger than 8 megaparsecs. And how much larger depends on how far you're willing to push perturbation theory. That's a judgment call. Okay, but that's where this sigma 8 goes. This is now the mass variance. So this is the numbers, and the mass doesn't have to exactly trace the galaxies when you have a lot of dark matter, but this is sort of a calibration of the zero point of this. So this is the shape. P goes as k to the n. This is the amplitude at 8 microparsecs, how much RMS is there in the mass. And because of this choice, it does turn out to be close to 1, but like n, not exactly. Like 0.8 or something like that. There's even a bit of tension now between galaxy measurements, which favor slightly the smaller values than Planck. But that still doesn't give us really any intuition for what's going on. So something in our experience we can think about is the weather. And so here is the temporal variation over the year of high and low temperatures here in Cleveland or in Santa Barbara where my in-laws live. You always have to read the scales here. So in the winter, the average high temperature is around freezing. In summer, it's up around 80 degrees at the highest point. So there is an 80 degree Fahrenheit swing over 6 months. Santa Barbara almost has no seasons. There is a little bit, but the average high goes from 65 to 70 something. So it's only a 10 degree swing Fahrenheit. So the amplitude of that swing is much smaller. The time scale is the same. So if you take the power spectrum of temperature variations, you will find that there is a lot of power on annual timescales. Right, that's the seasonal signal, and so you have this modulation is big for Cleveland, but it's smaller there. So they would both have power at that same timescale, but there'd be more power in our weather than in Santa Barbara. Okay, that's the seasonal variation. There's the daily variation from whenever I looked at the forecast to do this. And notice first, Santa Barbara is just very much the same day to day to day to day. It's basically what happens in a Mediterranean climate where you are regulated by the thermal bath of the ocean right next door. And so just getting the same weather every day. That is a very strong periodicity, so there's a lot of power on 24-hour scale. Right, that's where all the variation is. Cleveland, we have the same diurnal variation, so there will be a lot of power scales, but we also have trends, sudden cold fronts come through, warming spells, and so on top of the daily variation, there are these larger scale trends. So there is some power, but not as much on that 24-hour scale. And there also is significant power on scales in between that is almost lacking in Santa Barbara. Right, so this is a power spectrum of this with the Fourier transform of this would almost give you two delta functions, one for this annual variation and one for the daily variation. Whereas this would be messier. It would have more power on its longer time scales, but also more power on sort of intermediate time scales, and sometimes, but probably less on daily time scales because the periodicity is not considered. So that's what we're trying to measure on. This is a temporal variation, but the same thing is what we're doing for galaxies and the microwave background on scales on the sky, spatial scales or angular scales. But the RMS is how much variation there is. So you could also imagine going to a third place, a really hot desert climate, probably the Sahara, something where daytime highs get really high but then crash very low at night. So you would have the same diurnal variation but a larger amplitude. So then there would be the same, there would be more power on that same diurnal time scale. Okay, so I use this example because it was what a clever friend of mine, Ho-Jun Mo, once used to help me understand it, so I hope that helps you. And if not, well, it's just hard to wrap your head around these damn things. They do get easier just by repetition, so at some point I hope it becomes more apparent. Okay, so now let's go and look at this power spectrum for the early universe. This is a snapshot of the universe from planet. When it was just a few hundred thousand years old, that surface of last scattering, when the universe transitioned from being an opaque plasma to a transparent neutral gas. And so what we see on the sky, all over the sky, is the same temperature everywhere, but these minute fluctuations in temperature, which is what we're trying to measure with the power spectrum. And this surface of last scattering is to be taken quite literally. At higher redshift, photons are scattering off of charged particles all the time. The mean free path is a few meters. And then when the whole universe transitions to being neutral, its opacity drops abruptly, and the mean free path becomes gigaparsecs. So basically, the photons have been released from this opaque cloud, just like if you look at a cloud in the sky, you cannot see into it, but you perceive it to have a surface. That's the point of last scattering, where photons are trying to get out of there and actually do so. Okay, so now we see this pattern of fluctuations in the sky, and you can see the answer with your eye. There are some power on large scales, really big clump here, really big clump there. That's variation that's way down here, because remember, this is the inverse of the angular scales. This is large angular scales here, small, very fine scales here. But that's not what really grabs the eye, is it? What matters is the little lumps, little lumps. There's lots of variation on that. Basically 1 degree psi, and that's what that first peak tells you. There's a lot of variance on that size of about 1 degree. And then there's finer variations, and there's these series of peaks. If this were a pure cold dark matter universe, then we wouldn't see this at all because there'd be no baryons and it would be boring. But in that limit, there would be no baryonic drag, and so all these peaks would be the same amplitude. But the baryons cause a drag, so you should see a damping spectrum, so each peak should be lower than the one before it. And that's true here to here, but it's not true here. The third peak's about the same amplitude as the second peak. So we know we need something extra in the universe. That's what we attribute to cold dark matter, and so that's the driving term, the parent pushing the child, whereas the child is trying to drive its feet. And those oscillations are frozen in the plasma at the time and get washed out by the growth of a large-scale structure because their scales overlap. And the dark matter doesn't know about those. But on smaller scales, some of them can be preserved, and those are the wiggles that we saw already in the power spectrum. This is just a different representation. But those are the so-called baryon acoustic oscillations that you hear people talk about. And that was discovered in the mid-aughts in large galaxy surveys. And so that scale is another thing that matches up scale-wise with where these things are. And so the geometry of the universe, the angular size distances, have to be very close to lambda CDM for this to work out. Okay, but I just mentioned that. That is the statistical measure of this, right? This is the real data. Where are the galaxies? You do a Fourier transform of that, and you get these blue points. That's just sort of the two-point correlation function. It's just the first moment. You can do higher order moments, the three-point correlation function, and so on. So there's more information in this map that you can see with your eye than preserves into this. Another thing that you lose in this Fourier transformation is the phase information, right? In principle, these fluctuations ought to correspond to these fluctuations, that a positive oscillation in one is still a positive oscillation in the other. And that just gets washed out when you do this Fourier transform. So there is more information there than just a simple power spectrum. And again, to try to illustrate what's going on, I put a bowl of water in my sink, and you can see the ripples here. And the reason that you have that pattern of peaks and troughs in the microwave background is that there is a sound horizon. That is, there is a distance that sound waves can travel at the time of recombination. And so what you're seeing imprinted on the microwave background in that your power spectrum is the standing modes across the sound horizon at that time of recombination. Now, it's going on at all times on all scales, but because the moment at which the universe becomes transparent is fairly sharply defined in time, you're basically taking a snapshot of these node. So let's see if this will run. So this is a driven oscillation, right? I'm tapping it, and because it's a 2D thing, you get Bessel functions. But you also see that there are standing waves, which are imposed by the size of that. And that's basically what we're seeing in the microwave background. So if we think about it, here is the expansion history of the universe. It assumes inflation in this illustration. So you start out with these tiny fluctuations, and here's the horizon scale back then. That gets exponentially stretched. Well, the horizon scale doesn't, the universe does. These are like travel cones, so things that are in causal contact. So they start out in causal contact, and they get stretched apart. 3 times 10 to the 5 years, I have a CDM, it's more like 3.8, it's closer to 4 times 10 to the 5 years. But anyway, that is the approximate moment of recombination, and that's where those standing waves are. Getting a snapshot of those standing waves at that time, and then almost nothing interacts with those photons, they just propagate to us. So what we see is the fundamental mode, the location of that first peak, its scale, is just the standing wave. Basically, it corresponds to the scale size of the horizon. So, and then you have higher order overtones, right? So you have different wavelengths, and all wavelengths are present. Yes, And so the fundamental mode is the full scale of the horizon, and then you have overtones or integral divisions of that. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, like that. But what that means CMB surface was these tiny, tiny fluctuations. Remember, they're tiny. And we're observing them 13 and some billion years later. But there is a sound horizon. It's basically C over, I can't remember if it's 3 or the square root of 3, but this is plasma physics. You can work out what the sound speed is. And so that gives you a scale. How far can you go? Depends on the light travel speed. So then there is an angular diameter distance. So you can measure that scale theta, what is the scale of the fundamental mode, relate that to a physical rod. So the reason people have been so hot on measuring this in the CMB is that it's a probe of the geometry. It's basically the angular diameter distance test all the way to redshift of 1,000. All right, we struggle to do this for supernova, redshift 1, redshift 2, those are our best probes of the luminosity distance relation at fairly modest redshift. CMB skips you all the way to redshift of 1,000. Oops. Don't want to wake you up there. So this is the scale that corresponds to this first peak. And because of this dependence on the angular distance size, the location of the peak depends on the geometry and H-naught. How big is the universe? Right? And so that angular size scale being very close to 1 degree corresponds, for reasonable Hubble constants, to a flat Robertson Walker geometry. So that's why we say omega curvature is small, because if you vary the curvature, then basically anything with an open geometry puts the location of this peak at perceptibly higher numbers. So that open omega, no lambda universe that Ostreicher and Steinhardt contemplated would put this at 800, not 200. You could tell the difference very easily, right? We know where the peak is very well. And I mention that because, like I said, at the time in 1995, it wasn't obvious that lambda CDM was better than open, just without a cosmological constant. And I was still coming at it from the perspective that, okay, inflation's a theory, but I don't buy that much into it. But we've known for a long time omega matter was low and that cosmological constant was bad. So I did write a reply and just said, geez, we could maybe just live with an open universe. Because one thing that they very carefully did not mention was if it was lambda CDM, and this is what I pointed out, my little note at the time was, geez, that predicts that the expansion rate would actually be accelerating. How crazy would that be? And it wasn't meant as a prediction, because that's built into the theory. It's not like it was my prediction. It was just saying, there's a really crazy consequence to this stuff that you're advocating. And a few years later, it was observed in the supernova data. So the rest is history, as they say. So all of us come with philosophical baggage to this exercise. And what attitude you come to it does inevitably color how you interpret the data. Okay, so by this time everybody bought into cold dark matter, and this caused us to buy into lambda. And in fact, putting on a cosmologist hat, this was not observed until 2000. This peak was not really well located until then. When the supernova data were published, and I mention all this because it's easy to oversimplify the history of this, and I've talked to a lot of people who are taught in a class like this that we didn't believe in lambda, and then we had the supernova observations, and suddenly we did. That is exactly not how it happened. There were all sorts of different observations across a broad spectrum of cosmological constraints that led us, pushed us inevitably towards that. And the lambda, the supernova observations were not a discovery, they were the coup de grace that confirmed the picture that Sprecher and Steinhardt were pushing. Needed that accelerated expansion, something that in 1995 they were shy about even mentioning because it sounded too crazy then. So basically, the supernova made it okay to talk about accelerated. I was still nervous, that was 98, I was still nervous because all of the analyses of the supernova data at one level or another assumed that the geometry was flat. We didn't know that. It could still be an open universe, it could be something weird. And so when this was observed in 2000, I was like, oh, thank God. Putting on a cosmology hat. Putting on the hat of the dark matter skeptic, I was like, geez, this is too small. It was predicted to be up here. And that's another story that we'll save for next time. Because this is sort of the thing. Now, this review from Donaldson and Hu shows you all these variations, so changing the curvature, changing the dark energy, doesn't do much. As long as the sum is one, it still gives you very much the same location of the peak. Increasing the baryon density causes the amplitude of the fluctuations to be higher, increasing what they call the matter. It's really letting there be more dark matter. That pushes it down. But it also changes the pattern of these peaks. All right, so this is a little peak, big peak, second, third, you increase the baryon density, then it's a big peak, small peak. You get closer to just a pure damp pigment spectrum, which is what you would get in the limit of all baryons. And dark matter has the other thing. So again, if you remember our analogy of a parent pushing a child on a swing, the parent is the dark matter, providing the driving term, the child dragging its feet is the baryons, causing the drag, and eventually the drag wins. Parent gives up. So you add some top to that damping spectrum, as you must in a damped-driven oscillation like this. But the details matter, right? You can see a lot of differences in the structure there. And so while the primary goal had always been to measure the location of that first acoustic peak, because it's a great application of the angular diameter redshift test, all these other peaks provide us a lot of information about what the baryon density is, what the tilt of the power spectrum is, what its amplitude sigma 8 is, and on and on and on. So to narrow in on the role of baryonic and non-baryonic dark matter, I'm going to skip here, and I'm cheating here, because I'm going to normalize everything here artificially. Remember, that's not true, right? Baryons drive up the amplitude, dark matter drives it down in an absolute sense. But I want to emphasize how the shapes differ. So I'm going to cheat and normalize everything at that top. And the data I'm showing, I made these plots at the time in 2000 when Boomerang first measured this. So this was the first really credible measurement of where the first peak was. And it also gave you a constraint on the second peak. BBN, as we knew it at the time, gave you a baryon density in this range. This was a reasonable guess for the cold dark matter density. So this is just fixed cold dark matter variation of baryons, letting it get unreasonably big. BBN wanted somewhere between 0.02 and 0.04. That's these things. Observation, we're down here. And so that's what's driven our estimate of the baryon density away from Craig's 0.015 to something like 0.022. We need to drive this up. in order to suppress that. You need more baryonic drag for the amount of dark matter that you expend. Similarly, if we fix the baryon density to something reasonable and vary the dark matter density, well, there's a lot of oscillation if it's just dark matter, and as you reduce the dark matter, you can see the emergence of the power spectrum, and in the limit where there's no dark matter at all, then there's just a pure damping spectrum, as they described, where each peak has a lower amplitude than the one before it, just a pure damping spectrum. And the mix of these things is what gives us our constraint, and at the time this was not very constraining, but it did already exclude the models that we thought. These were the models that we believed going in, and we believed those because of Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And this is another thing, you go back and read this paper and they don't talk about this at all, because they knew it was wrong, and it was better not to. Because look at this, this is great. And it was. That was the main point, so I can understand why they wouldn't say this. But that was a problem, and for a few years there, the ethos was that, well, BBN was close but wrong, and this is the right answer. You know, what's a factor of two in the baryon density among cosmologists? So this whole thing is a Dampton-driven oscillator. There's a nice tutorial given by Wayne Hu on his webpage where I've taken this illustration. And so it's basically this damped and drag-driven thing. And another important thing that happens is that you get a phase shift between the baryons, which are strongly coupled to the photons, and the dark matter, which is not. And that phase difference is why you get a difference in which of these peaks are affected, the even odd component. So what's being illustrated here is you see these baryons, they are inside the little tiny potential wells caused by this. Oh, this is the basic thing I should take for granted, I should remember to tell you. Because the baryonic and photon fluids are coupled, the temperature observations that we see are coupled to the density variations. Those really are a one-to-one correspondence, the temperature variations correspond directly to the density variations that gravity can act on. So that's what we are measuring. We measure the temperature variance on the sky, and that is related to baryon density. There are actually two terms here which almost but don't quite cancel out, which is why there's that factor of one-third there. Okay, I'll come back to that next time, because that seems like quite enough for today. Any questions? Okay, if you have not yet turned in your homework, please do so. There's some old work here to collect if you have any outstanding. See you on Thursday.